Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with screenwriter, director, and now playwright Cameron Crowe. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll chat about the Broadway adaptation of his film Almost Famous, the famous boombox scene in Say Anything, and more. Let's jump in.
Mr. Kot, today our guest is the screenwriter, director of films like Almost Famous, Say Anything, Jerry Maguire, and more, and longtime friend of Sound Opinions. He got his start, though, in our profession, in the trenches, like us, music criticism and journalism, writing for publications like Cream and Rolling Stone.
His experience following Led Zeppelin for Rolling Stone magazine inspired one of our favorite movies, Almost Famous, which he wrote, directed, and won the Oscar for, Best Original Screenplay. And most recently, he turned the film into a Broadway musical, which just ended its run in New York. We'll talk to him about his career, the musical, and much more. Let's jump in.
We are thrilled to welcome back to Sound Opinions our old buddy Cameron Crowe. Not old as in old, but longtime friend Cameron Crowe. Better way to say it.
Exactly, exactly. Returning fan.
Returning Sound Opinions fan.
That's right.
Last scene when we screened Almost Famous for a couple thousand people at Millennium Park. Cameron had taped something for us to welcome the crowd. That was a good night, my friend.
I remember, and I think my mom was in on that.
Your mom was at your house, so she was in the video. Your mom, of course, is the principal in Almost Famous. She another lesser director, Martin Scorsese, your mom made cameos in all of your films until her death, sadly.
It's true. She would have wanted to be in on this. You know, it's her thing. You tell her you have a new script or something. She's like, what's my part? What am I doing?
Well, you know, seriously, that's a good place to start because I hadn't realized this, and you've been doing a ton of press for Almost Famous on Broadway. We want to talk to you about the difference between Broadway and films and the differences between the documentaries you've made and the features, but I think the place to start, Cameron, is with Mom. She used to drag you into San Diego to see musicals.
It's true, because we lived across the street from the Old Globe Theater, and you know, I wanted to stay behind and, like, do all the clandestine stuff, like listen to Black Sabbath and so forth. And she would say, you're less than a block away from Shakespeare. We can walk across the street. It's going to be great. You'll brag about this one day. So, you know, of course, that day came when years later they said, you know, you can open your off-Broadway musical in like Boston or Atlanta or San Diego, the Old Globe. So I said, okay, let's go to the Old Globe. But immediately started to regret it because, you know, if there's a problem, you don't want it to happen in your old hometown.
Yeah.
So it kind of upped the stakes a little bit. But she definitely was the big cheerleader for doing Almost Famous on stage. So we actually pulled it off for her.
Well, what were your memories of theater that impacted you as a kid? I mean, did that stuff make any impact on you at all? Like, oh, you know, filtering back into what you're doing now, perhaps?
The pageantry, Greg, it was kind of like, it was a version of a concert, I would find out later, because I wasn't going to concerts yet. So, but I would see, like, you know, real fan worship in some of those performances, because the Old Globe was patterned after Shakespeare's theater. And so real fans would show up to see these plays. And, you know, they were mostly kind of boring, but when they hit a dramatic moment, it was galvanizing. And that was what I took away, that, like, there's a thing that you can do in the theater that just kind of it happens in real time with real people. And I thought that was kind of explosive, and it translated in other ways until we came back to the same theater. And miraculously, people just kept showing up, and we broke all the records and for the Old Globe. And the thing that's both typically Alice Crowe and so her is that she passed away 2 days before the first audience came in to see this play that she'd been championing for decades, really. Mm. So it was classic dramatic positioning for her exit. She was like, okay, I'm going to make sure this lands. And so the whole cast really kind of upped the ante, and they were very, it was some powerful performances that happened in San Diego, which we tried to bring to Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what did you think the first time Alice, your mom, said, Almost Famous, the movie, should be a Broadway musical? Did you think, you know, Mom, what are you smoking, crack? What are you doing?
a little bit, but she would, she worked the VCR like a maestro. You know, she would, like, grab stuff off TV with the VCR, and she would always be sending me or showing me a Neil Simon interview or a Stephen Sondheim documentary. So she was always kind of like seeding the land for something that might happen in that direction. But, and Sondheim was the one that did it for me, because I loved the song Barcelona that's in Company. Mm. And I thought that was as good as, like, my favorite singer-songwriter songs.
Where you going?
Barcelona.
Oh.
Don't get up.
Do you have to?
Yes, I have to.
Oh.
Don't get up.
So that was kind of the road that took me into, like, saying, we should do this. Yes, let's do this. And then it was like meeting the people that can teach you a little bit about it.
Well, I have to confess, Cameron, I got to see Almost Famous in that initial run at the Globe, and what a beautiful theater, and it was a great night. why was I in San Diego? I was talking at the Lester Bangs annual memorial reading at Grossmont Junior College, which he did not graduate from, but they have a star on the walk. I don't know if you made it out there to El Cajon, you know, which he would have thought was rich, I'm sure. You know, and it was with trepidation. I am allergic to Broadway. There's two kinds of great singing, great being relative. Broadway singing, which is, you know, the blood of the martyrs will water the meadows of France, right?
Yeah.
And then there's what we've devoted our lives to, you and me and Greg, rock singing.
Yeah.
Right? And I was so happy that Almost Famous didn't devolve into the Broadway singing. It was natural. It was more like, you know, reminded me, not that there's anything thematic, it reminded me of Godspell, which I saw as a kid, and it really affected me. It was like a bunch of music-loving hippies are singing these songs. They weren't doing the Broadway schmaltz, right?
Get in, get out, get the story. Always on to the next one. But I am not supposed to make friends.
Were you concerned at all about that? And how that, there are the, you know, because, like, Broadway singers don't think like rock singers.
Was I concerned about it?
Yeah, the theater people would not get the way to put those songs across.
Every minute, every hour, every day. How can I answer in the affirmative any more strongly? I was kind of grumpy about it from time to time because people would be loving it, and I would say, like, well, you know, if the Who or something like the Who doesn't appear in terms of rock intensity in this show, I'm out. You know, I can't sit here and believe that it's the correct story. And what's great is everybody dug in to understand what the rock thing was. And it really began with casting, mm-hmm. because all the actors would come in and they would start with a song that was from the 70s canon, you know? So they would show their colors immediately about how rock they were. And some of them would do like Barracuda and things like that, not knowing I had personal history with Heart, and you know, yeah, it'd be a little like, bit, yes, yeah. Yes, good choice, you know, yeah. Maybe they did know, but we tend to winnow out the people that didn't understand or that weren't a true fan of the form, you know, which is how we cast the movie too.
Yeah.
So it's all music lovers in the cast, and the guy who plays Lester.
Yeah.
Who you know, Rob Coletti, Chicago's mm-hmm. Rob Coletti.
Columbia College grad, yeah.
He's just the greatest. I feel like he's kind of been a partner for this whole later life for Almost Famous because mm-hmm. he's such a Lester follower, as you know. But he's also like deeply in love with music mm-hmm. and is a musician himself. So when he gets up there and opens the show and talks about, you know, Van Morrison or Lou Reed or whatever, you feel it. You know, this actually reminds me quite a bit of Lester himself, you know, who you have very vivid memories of. And I do too. And Philip Seymour Hoffman caught so much of like the inner power and more of Lester.
I'm glad you were home.
I'm always home. I'm uncool.
Me too.
You're doing great. Yeah. The only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're uncool.
Rob Coletti, as soon as he walked in to do the audition for us, I felt the Lester's warmth, you know, and the warmth that was surprising to me when I met him. And you know about it, and, yeah. and in stuff you're working on, that warmth and that heart is very present, which is great. So I love that there's a warm kind of version of Lester, who's also funny and corrosive, that opens the show basically by saying, it's over.
Yeah.
You know, what you loved about music is over. It's the first lines of the musical. It's like, it's over.
Right.
And what I love is it ends with William Miller saying, what do you love about music? And Russell Hammond says, to begin with,
right,
everything. So I just like the shape of like, it's over, it's beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the life of the music fan, you know, yeah. and the ride you take with it. So anyway, to over answer the
no,
question.
No, yeah, I can see that.
That's what it is.
That's a great way of saying it. And I think, you know, I think part of the problem with Broadway style singing is, you know, a lot of it's about exposition. You've got to explain it. It's almost there's so much emphasis on the words that the music sometimes gets short shrift. But I was curious, it's a daunting hill to climb, as us rock lovers know. So I'm just wondering if you'd have any examples in your catalog of stuff that this was a musical that did rock justice on Broadway or anywhere, you know, regional theater, wherever you may have seen it. Do you have any, were there any inspirations like that in as you were kind of formulating this?
Yeah, Greg, the thing that I said in the very first meeting about this was my dream would be that like there'd be a high school production version of Almost Famous that if you're 15 or 16, you're psyched to put on. And I that's my real dream, really, that it lives like that. Cause I remember the plays that we would play at my schools and it was like Guys and Dolls and stuff like that. So I thought like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if Almost Famous was in a gymnasium and they, you know, it was their spring show at a high school or, you know, San Diego High School or something would be amazing. So the thing is, like, can a Broadway audience take a show that handles music more as a concert than as a showy event? You know what I mean? Can it be a little bit of both? And can people that love theater come and see the show and eventually hold hands with rock fans, music fans? And they do. By the end of the show, you know, we end with a reprise of Fever Dog. And every night in San Diego and also in New York on Broadway, everybody's standing. So they've kind of like, and they're rocking out with Stillwater, who plays live, which is really cool. So, you know, it's ambitious. And when we first started putting the show on, some of the people that came to see it, you know, who were interested, the OG theater people, you know, they had to get tenderized for it because they're kind of not used to seeing, you know, Jeff Beebe and Stillwater doing the Midwestern hard rock thing, you know. Yeah. But now I think it's settled in a great way, and people, they know there's an ending that's about kind of, there's a curtain bow that happens at the end of the show that's really exciting, and all the cast appear in it. Every character gets to sing part of Fever Dog, and it kind of brings everything together. And people now know that that's coming, because when the show is over, they don't leave. They're ready for this curtain call of Fever Dog, which is I'm maybe proudest of. Right after, maybe it'll end up in a high school sometime.
That is a great thought. It really is. You handled that so deftly, my friend. Tenderized. They needed to be tenderized. You know, there's
tenderized.
We're all critics.
Toughened.
Toughened. Yeah, we're all critics. We're all journalists. The New York theater press was pretty brutal, and yet people are loving the show and coming to the show night after night. How did that feel? I mean, you've had bad reviews for movies before. It must be similar. But I mean,
well, he was like listening to Black Sabbath records that the critics savaged, and millions of kids bought it and were influenced by it for decades later.
Yeah, so. He's telling Rolling Stone, I'm going to go on the road with this guy, Peter Frampton. And they're like, he's nothing. He's a teeny bopper, right? You know, or I mean, you've been down this road before, but geez, man, I was crying for you.
I'm the master of reality of Broadway shows right now. You know? The fans know. No, it's here's what's funny. And I love that you asked about it, because, you know, you're always kind of asked to compare the Hollywood movie making version of putting on a show to the Broadway version. So me having come from the world of movies, like a lot of the and storytelling that way, a lot of the people involved as we were putting the show together would like kind of take me aside and go, you know, there's no close-ups in the theater. There's no, you got to get used to it. There's no close-ups in the theater. The close-ups are when they sing. And I'm like, I know, I know. I picked this up, you know?
Yeah.
And I loved leaning into it as a, you know, cause I love knowing a character backwards and forwards, and, you know, you feel like you fall in love with them when you hear the story and stuff. And the songs helped me do that. Mm. But what it always was supposed to be is a show that like brought everybody together, especially the ones that had never been to a Broadway theater. Anyway, the point is, in movies, also, if something gets dinged early on, man, everybody looks for another job. Everybody moves on. Yeah, everybody's like picking up the phone and reading new scripts, and the wind shifts overnight.
Yeah.
So some of the reviews that dinged us on the Broadway show, it strengthened the cast. The young man who Casey likes, who plays William, I'll never forget it. The first morning after some of the reviews ran, some of them not bad for sure, but here comes Casey running down the street, skipping, saying like, "F them all, man! We're gonna triple down. This show is everything." And I looked at this kid, and I'm just like, "That is it, and that is unique to this situation. These people are there to put on a show, and they tripled down."
Yeah.
And I think the reviews that were on the unkind side strengthened the fan base for the show. Mm. So people come in and they claim the show more than ever. And for a show that's all about fandom, you know, there was a line that was that's still in the show and in the movie and everything, which is when Russell Hammond goes, "We play for fans, not critics."
Yeah.
It started to get applause.
Yeah.
I'm like, I never wanted to be like the Bachman Turner Overdrive kind of musical where, like, you know, the fans are the only ones that understand, because it's not like that. But I did love the thing of like, let's put on a show and let's make it better.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They push back. We're going to push back harder. And that's the rock spirit. And that's what you get every night at Almost Famous.
When we return, we continue our conversation with Cameron Crowe about critical response to art. Plus, we talk about films like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Jerry Maguire, and working with J.J. Abrams. That's coming up on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. Let's get back into our conversation with Cameron Crowe.
You know, I got to say this because, you know, you're a guy who comes from criticism. I mean, you were critiquing bands, you were covering them, and you kind of had the last word on a band when you would write a profile or whatever. And then you become, now as a movie maker, you're on the other side of that dynamic where people are critiquing your stuff.
An artist.
And Jim and I, you know, write books, and it's interesting to be on the flip side of the critiquing, like your stuff is being critiqued.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to have a thick skin, A, but B, sometimes you can learn stuff if it's really an incisive thing. And C, I have found that I learned more about the critic than I did my book, whatever. Mm. You know, it's like, I know where this person is coming from when they're reviewing my stuff. I learned to sort of process it that way. Like, it's more about their feelings than the actual thing being critiqued. And, like, some of these people probably had a chip on their shoulder, whatever. I don't know if you can see it from that perspective, you know, because you've been on the other side for so long.
I also know that time is an important participant in all this stuff. Mm. When Fast Times at Ridgemont High first came out, you know who was actually violently troubled by the movie? Roger Ebert. Mm. Roger Ebert thought that we were actually taking advantage of young Jennifer Jason Leigh. And the review was brutal and almost scary. I mean, especially since Jennifer Jason Leigh was the major proponent of the raw stuff in the movie, because she wanted to, like, be real, man. And the fact is, over time, Roger Ebert changed his opinion. Mm. And we talked about it. Similarly, Vanilla Sky came out. And that was when, like, a bad review would, I would carry it around for days in my heart, you know, just like, what happened? What did I do wrong? I hear about Vanilla Sky all the time now. The people that love that movie are powerful about their advocacy for it. And what happens is they kind of don't remember some of the early feelings. Almost Famous, you know, it got good reviews, but it fell out of the theaters in days because
I was gonna
nobody
ask
came
you about
to see
that.
It.
You know, I saw Almost Famous sitting beside Roger in the screening room, you know, and we both loved it and then went back to see it again. And
But people forget it came and went, right? Mm. Here you were, yeah. You know, bunch of Academy Award nominations for Jerry Maguire, right? You have put phrases in the popular lexicon, show me the money, right? And then Almost Famous comes out, oh, he's done.
Jim, it fell off the screen in theaters. It yeah. was just like nobody came, yeah. but they discovered it later.
It's had this life. I mean, people are religious about that movie now.
Well, the thing is, and I'm lucky that I've had enough of a kind of a career where I've been able to do stuff for a while, which is like way beyond the wildest first dream I ever had, which was to like have a story in Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
But what nobody can dispute is when a story is real and it's being told from the heart for all the right reasons, you're never going to lose. Mm-hmm. It will find people because there's a high-pitched signal that goes out when something is being made from the right place for all the right reasons about the right things. And I know Almost Famous is that story because it's true. It happened mm-hmm. to me. It's my family. That is the guy that I met. That is the plane flight that almost went down. I mean, it's like you can criticize it or you can embrace it, but it's, I got to say, it's authentic.
Well, and I admire your courage, Cameron, because the movie is much beloved and people have an ownership over it, right? And it would have been okay to rely on what they call needle drop or jukebox, right? Just the songs yeah. that were in the movie. But your ambition, you sat down to write songs that would accompany, you know, we hear Tiny Dancer, we hear Fever Dog, right? But other songs were added. And I was wondering what that songwriting experience was like for you, working with a songsmith and adding these. So now you've got to like measure up. You better have new music that is going to be as strong as like Tiny Dancer. How do I do that?
Well, Tom Kitt, who is the songsmith you're talking about, was such a fun collaborator because we had all the same references, and he's a little more on the Billy Joel side and I'm more on the Led Zeppelin side. And where we come together, for example, on the Fever Dog with a new verse that closes the show is so fun. But he came in with a song called Morocco, which was a cousin of Barcelona, that song that I fell in love with of Sondheim.
Yeah.
And that was like the first song where I thought, okay, this is an extension of the movie. You know, this is taking the romance of Penny Lane wanting to go to Morocco and turning it into a song.
A new kind of life, a new kind of crowd. It feels so good to think it out loud. Morocco.
That reminds me of what I fell in love with about Broadway musical compositions, you know. So we started there. We have a new song for Stillwater called I Come at Night, which I'm very proud of. Mm-hmm. and the idea was to find that middle ground where you could play a game with the audience where they could say, well, is that an Elton John song that I never heard in the day?
Yeah.
Or is that a new song? Is that a Joni Mitchell song? No, that is a Joni Mitchell song. But the next song, huh? And so I liked having that element in the show. And it is, it's a fun game to play when you come see it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of a living thing too. It every night's a new night, right? It can change.
It's true.
Are you tweaking and thinking about other iterations of how this thing will evolve? I mean, where is it at in terms of your head? Is it finished or is it still ongoing, the process of making this play?
That's one of the fun things about it. It's like a movie you finish and pretty much when they tell you like, oh, you can reshoot this or you can change this line and you can have them kiss at the end. It really never changes the movie. The movie pretty much is the movie you made. And when you first see it, that's how people see it around the world. Theater, you can change night to night. And it does change what happens in the theater. So that was a super fun thing for me as somebody that loves to change and try stuff when we're shooting and stuff. It was like every night the cast would give you a new version of something or a new speech. And that was really cool. At a certain point when it opens, it freezes. And then your next chance to mess with it is when it's having its life beyond Broadway, where it is a regional presentation. Yeah, like Chicago gets a lot of stuff on both sides of that, before Broadway and then afterwards. So there's some things I'd love to do for sure. I mean, I'll always be tinkering. Like Billy Wilder was still tinkering with the apartment, like when he was 93, and he had no chance to change the apartment, nor should he have. But yeah, there are things I'd love to mess around with and maybe try a new song and things like that. There was a song we cut that was Anika Larsson, who plays my mom's character, Elaine, that got cut, that I think a version of it can go back in. But it, you know, it's always going to be the Almost Famous story. Mm-hmm. And so I like moving around kind of the furniture a little bit, but the story is the story.
Cameron Crowe, footnote, also not accorded the accolades it deserved, your book with Billy Wilder, right? Based on Truffaut, Hitchcock, you know, two great filmmakers talking about the craft, Truffaut taking Hitchcock through. I love that book.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks. To me, it was the film school that I never got, you know, that I accidentally got or something. It's like he was supposed to play a part in Jerry Maguire, forgot that he had said he wanted to play the part. hire an actor. You're pissing on an old man's dreams. Leave me alone. then the movie comes out, and I get this call from Billy Wilder saying, I enjoyed your picture. If you'd like to interview me for your column, I'm available on Wednesday. I'm like, okay, well, I have no column, but I'm going there on Wednesday, and I'm going to start interviewing him.
Yeah.
So we did that for a year and a half.
Wow. I show my journalism as literature class his version of The Front Page, right?
Oh, wow.
Which I think is vastly underrated, right? I mean, the play is the play, but the way he filmed that classic of Chicago journalism, but that's straying far afield. You know, I wanted to ask you about your recent films. You know, we had the Pearl Jam doc, and we had the Crosby doc. We had your foray into long-form television, which is so exciting right now. You did it with Roadies, and of course, you know, the filmography. What have you been learning in playing at these different forms? The documentary, the feature film, you know, the series on television.
Great, great question. Different lessons for each one. For doing stuff for Broadway, being succinct has been a great takeaway, because I am the original, not the original guy. I'm one of the guys that will write a 200-page script when 100 would be better.
Right.
So the Broadway experience is like, you know, you don't have all night. Mm-hmm. You're not going to go shoot a whole bunch of stuff and use what works best. You got to, you know, shoot your shot right there. So that's been really helpful.
Focus
on what's coming next. Just boil it down to send it a few drafts beyond what you would have. Long form television, I'd love to try again. That was really J.J. Abrams who he and I were both writing movies at Jim Brooks's company, Gracie Films, at the same time. And so Wes Anderson was there at the same time. Mm. And we all became buddies, you know. And at one point, J.J. said, you know what? I'm going to take a different road. I'm going to go do some other stuff, and I'm going to be my own producer. You know, I love what you guys are doing here with Jim Brooks, but it's not the only road. And I thought, well, that's a courageous thing. So he went off and basically did Felicity and stuff and started his whole career in TV. And later, Tom Cruise was interested in J.J. Abrams for Mission Impossible and had asked me about him. And I raved about J.J., and J.J. came and met Cruise. And so I had this great relationship with JJ through the years. And then one day he's like, if you do TV, let me do it with you. And so Roadies was kind of like holding hands with JJ and saying like, let's learn what we can. And what happened was, you know, a lot of lessons were learned about like directing my own stuff was the call on some of those episodes of Roadies. And so I learned a lot about the strength of storytelling and how it happens in TV. And I feel like we were just kind of getting our rhythm when the show ended. And that cast was wonderful.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of the ensemble. And so I want to use some of the theater ensemble actors for our next movie, because I like working with a big ensemble and stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I think these projects that you mentioned are all learning experiences. We Bought a Zoo was like, okay, what about telling a story for that kids would like mm-hmm. and understand as well as adults, you know? And that was an interesting melding. And I thought Matt Damon, super underrated in that movie. Mm. And that's another movie, Jim, that got dinged a little bit when it came out, or people laughed about the title. Mm-hmm. But I hear about We Bought a Zoo.
Yeah, yeah.
Tons.
Yeah.
Especially during the pandemic, people really found their way to We Bought a Zoo.
It's amazing how much stuff got found during the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. It's so yeah, yeah.
What was tougher for you, first movie or first play?
Ooh, probably first movie, because there were so many people there that the film had gathered. So my friend Clay, who's our production designer now, he was working with me as kind of an assistant at the time. Clay Griffith, I remember, I was in a trailer and it was the first day of shooting, and Clay Griffith came in the trailer and he said, you know, you got to leave the trailer at a certain point. Like, really? Really?
I have to.
Yeah. And so like we shot the first day, and then I like went back to the trailer and I was just sitting there going, oh my God, what's happening? These are the rapids of all time. And Clay comes and goes, you know, you got to leave the trailer again and have lunch with the crew. It's really important that you let the crew know that you're one of them. Uh-huh. And here, let me take your hand and lead you to the crew. And you know what? It was a lesson that was so learned on that day, because, you know, you talk about lessons learned. The crew will save you or let you die when you're making a movie, because they are all there to make the best movie possible and their hearts are in it. And it does start at the top, whether it's the top actor or the director. It sets a tone, and when the crew knows that you're with them and they're with you, man, it's movie making sings.
I can understand how that's daunting, though, Cameron. I can understand William knocking at the door, please let me in, I'm here to interview Black Sabbath, right? You're on the set, and are we talking Wildlife, or are we talking, when you said first movie?
Say Anything.
Say Anything.
Right, I went to Say Anything.
Say Anything. All right, so you're making Say Anything, and I can understand, like, there's grips and focus pullers and stuff who've been in this for 50 years, 40 years, right? You know, and you're like, got to be intimidated. I'm like supposed to be their boss, you know, not to mention the actors.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to follow your heart. And sometimes ultimately, you know, when it's wrong and you know when it's right. And a lot of times things are in the gray area and you got to hope that you got a scene right and things like that. Even Billy Wilder said he figured out how to shoot the day's work at the corner of La Brea and Melrose as he drove home at the end of the day every day. Yeah. You know, you're always learning. Like on Roadies, Ron White, the comedian Ron White played, you know, the former Lynyrd Skynyrd roadie that's now kind of the patriarchal figure in that group of workers. I came up to him one day and I was trying to tell him the importance of Ronnie Van Zant and Lynyrd Skynyrd. And he was doing a speech about Lynyrd Skynyrd at the time. And I was like, you love this guy. When you talk about him, your soul rattles. You're just like, you feel that music. When he died, part of you died. Mm. Like, you know, do you know what I mean? And he said, no. And I go, well, do it faster. And he goes, that I understand. So it's like, it changes every time. You know, it's whatever it takes to get the story told. And that's what makes it fun.
Coming up next, we finish our conversation with Cameron Crowe by talking about his experience securing Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes for the pivotal boombox scene for Say Anything. That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. This week we're talking with Cameron Crowe. Let's get to some of his favorite music moments in his films.
Well, Say Anything turned out okay. So many of these movies did. Greg and I have talked with you before. We've done our, you know, the iconic Cameron music moments, right? The boombox, right? American Girl, so on and so forth. I wanted to ask you, flip it this time, and ask you a couple of moments that you think absolutely clicked between soundtrack and images on the screen that you're proud of. Because I bet they're different than the ones all the fans have.
Wow. Well, we talk about some of them are the same, but we talk about We Bought a Zoo. There's a scene where Matt Damon is kind of summoning the memory of his wife, and he's in a kitchen and he's on the floor with his laptop and he's alone, and the laptop iPhoto library comes to life. And there's a scene in the park where they're now surrounding him in this kitchen, and he summons the memory in a visceral way, and the characters, you know, it's a flight of fancy, the characters appear around him, and I think that's one of the best scenes that I've ever been lucky enough to have in one of my movies. I mean, it still blows my mind to say one of my movies.
Yeah,
you know? I'm still a rock critic for Cream. You know, that's how I really feel sometimes.
So
a lot of the time. Matt Damon made that scene come to life. There's another scene in We Bought a Zoo where he has an argument with his son about the dream of starting the zoo, and I'm super proud of that scene. I also love the ending of Aloha, which is, I think, some of Bradley Cooper's best work. You know, so there's always things that give me a tingle, and they do generally when you film them, and it survives that feeling, and that's when it's really great. I'll give you one from Fast Times. I love Sean Penn in the 7-Eleven. With Brad Hamilton, you know, where the robber's going to come in and they're going to throw the coffee.
Yeah.
And it's basically the end of the movie. But the acting between Judge Reinhold and Sean Penn, young Sean Penn and young Judge Reinhold at that counter is fantastic.
Yeah, they're great.
And so Yeah, I just like, I geek out over this stuff.
People on lewds should not drive.
Well, you know, that's a favorite.
You know,
that's
a lot of us learned important lessons by watching these movies.
Life lessons.
These are life lessons. Yeah, not the ones my mom really wanted me to get out there.
No, your mom would never discuss lewds with you, but your movies would.
But like I say, she wanted to be in those movies.
Yeah, and now you're on Broadway. So, Mom,
it's wild.
I did you justice. Yeah.
Just to add this, like we've talked so much. I have talked so much about my mom just in you know, talking about the play and everything. I feel like when I go to see the show, I like talk to people. I love talking to everybody and, you know, signing playbills if they want them signed and all that stuff. I love it. You don't get to do that after you screen a movie generally.
You don't meet anybody.
So but they'd be like, yeah, you know, your mom really seems like she was a special person. And I'm like, yeah. And if you really want to meet her, like if you want to see her unguarded, who she really was, put on Jerry Maguire, or when Jerry Maguire is on your TV some night and it comes to the scene where Tom Cruise comes to say, you know, you complete me and all that stuff.
In front of the support group of divorced women.
In front of the support group. He pleads for... He waves the flag for love at that key moment. But before he walks in, my mom forgets that there's a camera. She's part of the divorced women's group that's in that living room when Tom Cruise comes and has his reconciliation with Renee. So my mom has now taken over this group of comedian and actors and is now counseling them like she did as a college counselor. And she's talking about the neural pathways of the brain and stuff. And it's like, that's her. That's the unguarded Alice Crow. And so I'm just, if you ask about things I'm proud of, I'm so proud of that because, you know, of all the stuff that's been maybe influenced by my mom, that's pure her. And it lives forever in one of Tom Cruise's best scenes.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
Walk away, right? Walk away.
Yeah, I think the problem is, you know, Alice, you were saying earlier something about the biorhythms.
I was saying that the neural pathways are set, and that's why it's hard for people to change. That's why behavior doesn't change very often.
I got one more musical question for you. I was listening to an interview with Tarantino actually this morning about music, his, you know, how he picks music for movies. And he said, there are certain songs that I have to have for a movie. Like he said in this interview, I hadn't heard this before, for Reservoir Dogs, that he needed to have a Stuck in the Middle with You by Steeler's Wheel in that movie. He had a $30,000 music licensing budget. He had to spend the entire licensing budget for that song. But he said, it's so important. I have to have it, whatever it price. And then he paid for the other songs by, they got a soundtrack deal. And they said, we'll pay the artist this way. So he was able to manage it. But that song was so important that he was able to, he said, I have to blow my whole budget to get that song for this movie. And obviously, an iconic scene. He knew what he was doing. Was there ever a moment for you like that when you were making a movie? Because the songs are so integral to what you're doing that you said, I have to have this song in this movie here, and I'll pay whatever it takes to get it.
Many, many times that's happened. And the best example of that was there was only one song that was ever going to work for the boombox scene in Say Anything. Mm. There was only one song. We tried everything. There were even songwriters that came in and tried to write an original song for that, which is it's your worst version of the Broadway thing. two guys came in and they wrote this song that's like, I hold my heart in the box ahead of my head. And you're like, oh God, it's the scene's going to get cut. We don't have a song for it. And then I was driving into the editing room and the only tape I had, like when I reached for a tape, was this tape from my wedding, just like a wedding mix. And In Your Eyes came on. And I'm surprised I didn't get in a car accident. I started racing to the editing room because it was all there. Mm. Like I drive off in my car and about instincts. And it was just like, oh my God. So I raced into the editing room. We put it on. It's perfect. And so then we began to, Peter Gabriel hadn't given his stuff for movies, I don't think, at that time. So we began the journey to try and get In Your Eyes. And it's a much longer story, but he turned it down. I sent the tape. He turned it down right about the same time Stevie Ray Vaughan was going to score Say Anything for a Minute. And then that fell away. And so, like, all these things were starting to cave in musically. And then it became known that Peter Gabriel thought it was the John Belushi movie Wired that wanted In Your Eyes. And so Rosanna Arquette actually did a little work for us. She was his partner. They were together at the time. And she was advocated for watching the tape of Say Anything, which he had gotten confused with Wired. So he watched Say Anything and then said, yeah, okay, let's figure out if there's a way to do this. But in the meantime, to over-answer your question, Mark Knopfler had a conversation with Peter Gabriel where he said, essentially, they really want that song? You got them over a barrel. Ask for an enormous amount. I'm telling you, to this day,
Money for Nothing.
Listen to Money for Nothing or any Dire Straits thing except Mark Knopfler's score for Local Hero. That's a good one.
Yeah, you're right.
But like he talks Peter Gabriel into asking for the world. And what happened was a long negotiation happened where like we found money in the publicity budget and everything to pay for In Your Eyes, which, you know, obviously was worth it and everything. But I have a little twinge every time I see a picture of Mark Knopfler, like, you know,
yeah,
you subversive, you know, yeah, masquerading as a sensitive, quiet man.
Right.
What's
Knopfler done in the last decade? You're on Broadway. Oh, your filmography is up to like a dozen movies. You know, you stick around long enough, you have the last laugh.
It was only that song that was ever going to work. I'm telling you, it was.
It had to be a crime scene.
Yeah. I can see that.
It worked. You were right.
We could talk to Cameron Crowe all freaking day. Thank you, Cameron, for taking some time for us. Congratulations on the Broadway success. You know we're friends.
Thank you, brothers.
You know, here's a good way to end. Lester's in the air again, isn't he? I mean, that moment Fallon when the whole cast came and performed for Jimmy Fallon, Almost Famous, and Carmel and I are sitting watching. We'd seen Rob Coletti in San Diego, right? Oh, he's not singing. And then he pops up, and he stole the whole moment, right? He's on Broadway. You cast one of the actors of the last half century, you know, as Lester. You know, there was a play that started in San Diego that went to New York, that went to Chicago, you know, How to Be a Rock Critic. It seems, you know, and it seems to me, and I don't know why, I haven't been able to articulate it, despite having lectured at Grossmont Junior College on the subject. But it seems like we need Lester now. That honesty, brutal at times, but also humor, talking about our culture at this moment more than we've ever needed him. Don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a reason why he's in the conversation. It's going to happen because he was far ahead of his time, and he actually has a voice that speaks to right now.
Yeah.
And you know it for sure, Jim. And I just feel like it just feels right for now.
Yeah.
You know, whether we're doing something or anybody's doing something, it's the right flag to be waving right now. His voice was powerful and true and authentic and fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, viva Lester.
Yeah. Well, the great Cameron Crowe, a hit on Broadway, Almost Famous. And we look forward to whatever you bring to the screen next, whichever, my TV
Thanks,
screen,
man.
The big screen.
Next year.
All right.
Big screen. Ooh. Come on. Ooh. I'll be back for a tray. That's Sound Opinions.
Okay. All right.
Going.
Thank you, Cameron.
Cool, you guys.
Thanks, Cameron.
Thank you so much.
That wraps up our latest chat with Cameron Crowe, and now we want to hear from you. What's your favorite Cameron film and why? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org.
Greg, what are we got on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, a deep dive into one of our favorite new bands, Dry Cleaning, a conversation with that band. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Good stuff. Dry Cleaning is fantastic. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.